Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I got scared.
Here's John Williams.
Listening to Bill and Wendy today. I have a story to tell. This is John. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. Nice to have you on board. Remember, you can always call or text our show. It's 312-981-7200. And again, thanks in advance, Craig Anderson. We learned just walking into the studio, the executive director of the Illinois High School Association will join us to talk about the CPS appeal to the IHSA. I'm not exactly sure it's the IHSA's call, but we'll get to the bottom of this. Why is it that the kids can't participate in extracurricular activities during a strike? Steve Bertrand last week pointed out that you can use the kids as a wedge. Either side can. That is, if the kids don't get to play, then the pressure is put on maybe the teachers to settle the strike so that the kids not only get back into the classroom, but they get back under the gridiron and the chessboard and all of the things the kids do. Now, maybe that's an equal amount of pressure on CPS to give the teachers what they want. You know, settle the dang thing. But if I got to be king and the paperwork's tied up at Cook County, I would let the kids play. I would let the kids play. My understanding is the coaches get paid either way. There's nothing to keep the coaches from being there. And if it's a high-impact sport, you can have the medical staff and facility there, too. It seems to me like if this was a strike at the Lincoln Way School or, you know, some of the Catholic schools, I mean, I'm looking at some of the top schools in the Chicago area. Hello, Mount Carmel. Hello, Nazareth. I would think that the stink would be even greater about this. Warren Township, Glenbard West, Hinsdale Central, Manuka, hello. Top-ranked teams in the state that are not in the CPS district. I wonder if it was a suburban school district problem instead of a city school district problem, if the rancor would be even louder. Now, I don't know. People in the city of Chicago must like their sports as much as people in the suburbs. But having raised kids and sent them through high school and junior high in the suburbs, I know how crazily, disproportionately important sports are out there. And I just can't imagine the good people in the western part of Cook County or in some of those collar counties. I can't imagine people just going, well, they'll just have to work it out while your son or daughter is sitting out their senior year.
Well, not only is it impacting potential college opportunities or scholarships for athletes, but these days, just about every student has some sort of extracurricular because it's basically needed on a college application. If they're saying that they can't be a part of something because of that, they're just losing their edge in another person getting into a school over them.
That's an interesting point. I mean, yeah, you think, well, all right, that's the football team. You're right. If it's band, if it's orchestra, if it's soccer, if it's lacrosse, if it's chess, if it's the radio TV program and the kids aren't doing that, what a shame. What a lost opportunity. Saw a colleague a little while ago walking his daughter down the hall, and I said, so what's going on here? He said, the strike. I went, oh, gosh, of course. I said to his daughter, I said, are you having fun? What would you rather be doing right now, walking around the radio station with Daddy or going to school? She says, I don't want to go to school. I'd rather be here with Daddy. It's because maybe she has a swell dad. He's a wonderful guy. But she didn't seem to be so anxious to get back to third grade class. I mentioned that. I was listening to Bill. So anyway, we'll be visiting at the last half hour of the show. Where will you be at 2:35? Make sure Craig Anderson hears you and I hear you. That'll be at 2:35 this afternoon. The director of the IHSA explains the rationale behind all of this. And, okay, I have a side. I don't even have a kid in CPS. I just remember how important sports were to me when my kids, an extracurricular activity. One was in music and radio. One was in sports. And I very much valued those two things for the kids. So we'll just hear them out. I'm sure not going to argue with you, Mr. Anderson. I just want to know. You know, I was listening to Bill and Wendy today. I hope you do, too. It's a wonderful show on from 10 to noon here on WGN, and then on the stream, WGNradio.com, or wherever you listen to us on the stream, from noon to 1. And they started their show talking about scary things that happen in haunted houses, haunted neighborhoods, old shut-down hospitals. And they were talking about the things they did or used to experience as kids that were really scary to them. And obviously this comes to mind around Halloween time. Did you guys do this? Because I was going to call in with Bill and Wendy, but why crowd their show when I have my own? But when I was a kid, we would all, 15 of us little 4-foot-tall people, crowd into the bathroom, close the door, turn out the lights.
Ooh, I know where you're going with this.
Light a candle, and then they would all chant. Now, I've heard different versions of the chant, but ours would be, "I believe in Mary worship."
Interesting.
And when you did that enough, a ghost or Mary would appear in the mirror. I had nothing to do with that. I was not going in there. Was not going in there, was not doing that, never did. But Jean, my sister, did. And David Cook did. And Donnie Pfeiffer did. All the cool kids did. I did not do that. That terrified me. Frankly, ours, I think it might still terrify me.
Ours was just Bloody Mary, but you have to like spin around 3 times and then look at the mirror after the 3rd one.
Bloody Mary, turn around 3 times. Look
like Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, and then look.
And then you'd all scream.
Ah, nothing's there.
No, something was there. The other one that used to freak me out was playing with a Ouija board.
Yeah, that thing is a little freaky.
I mean, here I am, old enough to vote in a lot of municipal elections, and I'm still not real crazy about the Ouija board.
My mom has some terrifying stories about the Ouija board. Terrifying.
Where it spelled out truthful and bad things?
No, where things in the house would move and all sorts of nice things like that. I won't get into it, but lots of ghostly
paranormal
actions.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing is that's strange about Ouija boards is it's not necessarily that people experience something with the board, but they have weird things happen while a board is in their house.
Oh, wow, because we've had one on display for a couple of weeks now.
Oh.
Where Brenda digs it out during Halloween time and puts it up on our mantle.
That's intense.
Just inviting bad karma. Well, I would play the Ouija board as a kid with my sister Jean, and you put your fingertips on that little heart-shaped obelisk, and then it moves around to spell out yes, no, and whatever. Will I marry? What will his name be? Well, the thing would move on us, and I know I was never moving it, which means Jean was doing it. I need to bring this up with her. Jean, if you're listening, you were moving that thing, right? That one just kind of freaked me out then, and I'm not crazy about it now. And I'm not a scaredy cat about all of this stuff. I don't have big phobias about these things, but those were the two that as a child plagued me the most. And as an adult now, I'm still like, I don't know about that.
I've always been a skeptic, but when I was news reporting in Missouri, I did a October special on a paranormal group, and they brought me along for an investigation. And let me just tell you, stuff happened. Stuff happened. That I can't explain, that I searched every little way for it to be staged. And
you don't think it was Goober in the woods throwing a rock, huh?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Want to mention one other thing that might help you, and that is Blackhawks Radio tonight, right, on WGN. Hawks would like to kind of get back on their winning ways, lost their last game. They're at home. If you go to the Blackhawks game, I discovered this, I think it was last week, when I went to my first game this season at home. I brought my laptop with me. I had come directly from work. I was coming directly from work, and then I knew from the game I was going to go directly home. So I wanted to have my laptop at home, so coming from work, I just dropped it in my bag, and then I went to the United Center. And as they're queuing through that line, I see people opening up their bags and their purses, and I thought, this. And you wait a while to get in. And I finally got to the front and slid my wallet and my phone through, and then they looked in my bag, and the guy sees my laptop, and he says, "You can't bring a laptop in." I'm not exactly sure why that is. Why can't you bring a laptop into the United Center? Okay, so I didn't fuss. I said, "Yeah, all right." I wondered. So then I kind of pack it up and walk past all the other people, which is kind of a walk of embarrassments. It's like, oh, you dope, you don't know the rules. And this is the interesting part, and this is why I bring it up for you. if you get into that situation, I thought they'd say, just go to gate 9 and there's a guy there and they'll screen it or they'll store it for you. They don't do that. They say there's a trailer in a parking lot a couple blocks away. And you can store your laptop there. Because think about it. You could run it back out to your car, but I took public transportation to the game. So I didn't have a car. I've got my laptop, and I have no place to put it. So they said, well, we have a secure facility for people in just such a situation, which I would think is not just me. And it's not at the United Center. So you walk out of the United Center then, and you make a right, in my case, and you go to the end of the block, and then you make another right turn, and you go down half a block, and then you turn left, and there's a hospital there. Advent's got a place over there, and they have a big parking lot. In the back of that parking lot, and as he's explaining all this to me, my eyes just kind of glaze over. I go, I'll find it. There's a white trailer with a Chicago Bulls logo on it that I was able to spot. He said, go there and give them your laptop, and they will hold it for you free of charge. So I mosey out there, not really paying good enough attention to the directions they gave me. As I'm walking past an intersection across the street against the flow, because everybody's got their black and red on, right? And I've got my black and red on, but I'm going the wrong direction.
And you're going the wrong way.
Fortunately, there's a police officer there, and he's seen this before, you know. A guy walking with his bag against the grain of flow before the game. He goes, you got a laptop? I said, yeah. He says, you're going the wrong way, dude. It's over there. Go to that parking lot, go over there. So I go over there. And then there was two very delightful, helpful people at this trailer that I found. And I give them my thing. They say, okay, here's your ticket. You know, I was like A237. He says, give us A237. You get back and we'll give you your thing. And then he looks at me, and he was so smart. He says, take a picture of it right now. A237, the little slip of paper. I said, why? He says, because you'll probably lose this. And then when you get back here, you'll have it on your phone. I went, oh, yeah, right. I took a picture of it. When I came back after the game, I couldn't find the slip of paper. He was 100% correct about that. I whipped out my phone, showed him the picture. He gave me my laptop. But I do not understand why that's the rule. Why does it have to be that way? And why does it have to be that way? I don't have answers to you on those things. I'm just telling you that's the way it was. Okay, it's 120. This is WGN. My number's 312-981-7200. Cheryl on line one has a crazy story about her Ouija board after this. Hey, Cheryl, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm good.
What happened to you?
Well, this is a true story. I was there. It wasn't a friend telling a friend and on and on. I was actually there, but a bunch of women were playing with the board. And for one of the women, the plaque or whatever you call it, led her to a message from her aunt who was dead. And within 1 year, that woman was dead and she was buried by her aunt in Michigan.
And that's what the Ouija board said was going to happen?
It was her trying to contact her.
So the dead aunt...
It didn't specifically say within a year, you know, you'll be with me. It was a message from her aunt, and so we just kind of all thought that was really unusual. And then, as it proved out, within a year, she was buried with her aunt.
She, the woman that was also playing with the Ouija board. Well, how old was
yes.
this woman at the time that she was using the Ouija board?
In her early 40s.
Wow. So unexpected, tragic death. And the Ouija board
was... Yes, it was a...
And did you...
It was an accident. Mm-hmm.
Did you or she, was everybody kind of... What was the reaction in the room when that message came across the Ouija board?
We were all just kind of, you know, shrieking and trying to scare each other. But, of course, we had no idea what the future was going to hold.
But see, to me, so if you believe like I do that all Ouija board messages are just the other person pushing it around, right? I mean, somebody's mm-hmm. doing it. Somebody's, one of you two are manipulating it. It's kind of like a truth test between the two of you. That, you know, in my world, it just means that the other person that was manipulating that little plaque was spelling that out to kind of freak out this woman. I mean, that had to be what happened, right?
No, it was the woman who was manipulating the plaque or whatever you call the device. She was doing that on her own. so it wasn't anyone else manipulating that.
Well, that kills my theory entirely, doesn't it? We would always play with a friend.
Yeah, so we were each taking turns, and it was her turn, and she had the message from her aunt, and as I said, then within a year, she had died in an accident and was buried.
I'm sorry
to hear
all that.
Her aunt was calling from. Yeah.
One last thing about that, though, Cheryl. How specific was the message? That is, did she say, when will I die? Or, I mean, I wonder how comprehensive the message was. Do you remember what the Ouija board actually said?
No, I don't. This was over 25 years ago, so I don't remember specifically. But, you know, she was, you know, getting all scared because she said, it's my aunt and she's dead. And what the specific message was, I don't remember.
Thanks for the call, Cheryl. You've fully freaked us out in advance of Halloween here. Wow.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. You're welcome. Remember, 2:30, the head of the IHSA joins us to talk about the strike. John, aren't the kids being coached by teachers? The teachers are on strike. If they can't teach, they can't coach, say a lot of you. What the heck is a Pierre Delecto and why is everybody talking about it? On Sunday, Twitter users lost their collective minds when they learned that Pierre Delecto was not a bot or a random Romney super fan, but an account run by the Republican senator himself. Romney used the account to like critical tweets about the president while also occasionally defending himself. The Romney Delecto connection was first made by Slate's Ashley Feinberg. He mentions this Twitter supporter. Delecto, and somebody thinks, oh, that's, I've never heard of Delecto. Who's that supporting him?
Why do they think they can get away with it? Think they're not going to get caught?
Totally anonymous. I'm just going to say all this great stuff. No one's going to know it's me.
And the perfect mask will be Delecto. I mean, what is that?
For the record, I think there's probably already a band that's changed its name to the Delecto Romney Connection.
Well, if one hasn't, this would be the time to do it. Be first in line with that one. That's just amazing. Story's getting a lot of traction today and last night. We were on that a little bit yesterday, too. That story doesn't get any better. It's just strange.
Free ups of mind today, I let myself
go. At 1:37 on WGN, we were talking a little while ago about the teacher's strike and the kids being able to participate in extracurricular activities. The head of the IHSA talks to us about that at 2:35. John, the teachers are also coaches, says 708. You will always inconvenience someone with the strike. That's the point. Yeah, the kids really are the pawns in this. Aren't the kids being coached by teachers? If it's a strike, then they can't teach and they can't coach, says 630. I'm not sure that's true. I think the teachers and the schools can do whatever they want to do. You want to cross a picket line, you can. And I would not interpret a coach coaching as crossing the picket line. 708, coaching is an additional stipend in addition to the teaching salary. I understand that, but it's not prorated. They won't get more or less depending on how many games they do or don't coach. So there's no compromise for the teachers that way in crossing the line, nor is there any incentive. Hey, John says, 815, Round Lake was on strike for 6 weeks. My husband worked there and was a girls' varsity B-ball coach. I guess that's basketball coach. And they missed a lot of the season. There was no football that year. I know I'm in danger of, if Bertrand were here, he would remind me of this, of overstating the importance of sports relative to academics. I mean, kids go to school to learn. But, boy, if that's your, I don't care. You've only got 4 years of high school. And if it's your varsity years and you miss a year of football or softball or baseball, whatever your thing is, because the teachers can't work it out, I think that's a shame, particularly since I think you can do both. In my world, the teachers can go on strike. Listen, the issue will be the academics. It will be the strike. It will be the things on the table. You could still coach. You could still play the games. John, back when we were kids, we used to, in the southwest suburbs, go in the bathroom, close the door, turn out the lights, and say, I believe in Mary Worth. I think that's what I said Mary Worship. I remember it that way, but Mary Worth rings a bell too. Another 815er says, John, you were supposed to say, I believe in Mary Worth three times. Then terrible things would happen. And a couple of you said that about Ouija boards. John, my mother would never allow a Ouija board in our home. My aunt gave us one as a Christmas gift 1 year. and she put it in a black plastic bag, and then she put it in the trash and never opened it. John, you should watch Penn and Teller. One episode talks about the Ouija board and other supernatural things. They show how it's all fake. They had a doctor that explained the Ouija board. Well, explain the last call. The woman was doing the Ouija board by herself, connected with her aunt. The aunt, via the Ouija board, told her she would die in her year. This is a woman in, what did she say, her 30s or 40s? Within a year, she was dead and buried next to her aunt.
I think she said early 40s.
Early 40s. Now, the woman's playing the Ouija board by herself, which to me means then she was just faking all of her friends when she was doing it at that gathering. She was driving the thing all by herself and said, oh, it's my aunt. And then said the aunt said, you're going to die in a year. Ha, ha, ha. That'll freak everybody out. It happened. But that's what it has to be, right? It just has to be that coincidence. Couple of calls on that, producer Olive says. Okay. Tim, you're on WGN. What do you want to say? You're on the air.
Yeah, I was saying that when I was a kid, my mother and some of the mom friends around would always get together and either play cards or whatever. And this one day, they were playing the Ouija board. And so we were looking outside the window, watching them do it or whatever. They're doing their thing. And we must have made a sound or something like that. And they turned around and to yell at us, like, get away, you know, whatever. And as they turned back, the Ouija board was moving by itself. Whatever question they asked, it was moving by themselves. They all got scared. They packed it all up and threw it into the closet.
Now, that's getting your money's worth out of your Ouija board, isn't it? That's what the thing is
definitely.
For. Wow. Yeah. I'm sure that Penn and Teller will tell you that static electricity or something. I don't know. I don't know how that thing worked. I don't understand it. It kind of freaked me out, I'll be honest with you.
Oh, it definitely freaked them out. They sat down and talked about it afterwards, but they didn't touch it. They didn't, you know, we had our games in the closet and stuff. They just threw it in there, so we ain't touching it no more.
Done with that one. Thank you for the call, Tim.
You bet.
Have a good day. Hey, John, you're on the air.
I was a little boy during World War II, so I don't know what happened, but my mother told me a story. During World War II, the men were all overseas. Nobody knew if they were dead or alive, where they were located. So they used the Ouija board in the living room of our apartment on the west side of Chicago, and the Ouija board told them where my mother's brother was located exactly, but nobody knew it because nobody knew if he was either dead or alive or where he was located. And she told me the Ouija board told them where he was located.
And it worked out, huh?
That's where he was located. I don't believe it, but that's what she told me.
John, thanks for the call. 773 King John, we were working the Ouija with our fingers on top of the marker, and the marker hopped across the board with our fingers on top. It actually hopped across the board. Our fingers were on top. Got so scared we threw it out. For 3 weeks, other boards came to us. We finally stopped people from giving them to us as gifts. 847, how many hours of teacher aides or nurses could be paid for with the dollars the CTU is paying for WGN radio ads? I saw the figure that the union is paying for the advertising to make their position on the radio. I don't know if that's public information or not. It would not pay for a lot of teachers. A few, but not... It wouldn't be a deal breaker, or maker for that matter. And finally, about the schools, Barbara, what did you want to say? You're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. I would like to know where the state of Illinois got $1 billion to give the Chicago Public Schools.
No kidding. Good question, right? I saw that number. I know it's $1 billion. I know there's a debate about what they're doing with it. Where that came from, off the top of my head, I'm not even sure.
Well, can you find out and let us know?
I will put that on the radio. It should not be that difficult to find out. But the question was, where does that gun money go? Into what departments? It's a little more complicated than that, but yeah, that's a fair enough question. Okay, it is 1:44 on WGN. This is something we're going to bring up on the show tomorrow, but I'll just introduce the topic briefly here today. There's two things that Facebook is doing. speaking of advertising, one is that Facebook is going to allow things that they know not to be true in political ads on Facebook. Previously, they said that they would monitor that. Now they're not going to keep score on who's telling the truth and who isn't, which, as I understand it, is the way it is in broadcasting, too. If you run a commercial on the radio or TV, say, about your opponent, the stuff you say doesn't have to be true. And if the radio or TV station knows that it's not true, not only are they under no obligation to remove that commercial, they can't. We so protect political speech in this country that unless the rules change in the last 25 minutes, the rule has always been they get to pay their money and say pretty much whatever they want. And you've seen some things that made you shake your head, sometimes just because it seemed like not a bad play, right? Like, really, you think that's going to persuade me? But radio and TV stations have almost no control over the content of political ads. So if it's that way on Facebook, I'm not all that alarmed. I don't love it, but I mean, I've already sort of made that deal, or you know, the companies I work for already made that deal. That's just the way this industry works. The other thing that they're talking about doing is actually flagging fake news. And that, to me, is another question that you and I need to decide. Do we want them to do that? Do you want Facebook to say, here's a story, and you're getting this in your feed, but we've judged it to be inaccurate? Do you want something like Facebook to do that for you, to be a guide, if you will? Do you trust them enough to do that? Who's making those calls? I don't mind if they do. I honestly don't go to Facebook for news. I have a Facebook account. Maybe you do as well. Where I get my news is from the original sources. So I'll go to CNN or Fox News or the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and then I'll judge their biases the way I want. But I check those places. If somebody else is posting something from those places, I tend not to get it that way. I tend to just go directly myself to those places. So I'm not too personally disturbed by somebody else saying, oh, we don't know that we trust this source or this site. If you go directly to them anymore, you kind of wonder if what they're doing is the best way to report the story. My pet peeve is, and this is relatively new, but ever since Donald Trump became president, CNN will, anytime he gives a speech, run a headline that says the 41 craziest things President Trump said at his cabinet meeting yesterday. And by the way, there were 41 crazy things that he said, and 20 of them may not have been true. When he spoke in Dallas, when he spoke in Minneapolis, I don't know that we're going to get this when he comes to Chicago because it's not going to be a rally. But they'll always do that. They fact check him, which I'm okay with, but then they all just post in bullet form the most outlandish things he says. I'm not sure that's news reporting. If they want to sort of transcribe the whole speech, put it there, and then let you read it and decide, that's fine. But I think CNN has so crossed the line in terms of advocacy in their news reporting that you almost expect it from them anymore, and I'm disappointed in that. John Williams in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. The texts that continue to come in about the teacher strike are as much about what I've been wondering about lately, and that is, should the kids be able to play their games or do their extracurricular activities, is about the issues in the strike. You know, I'll just make this other observation, and tell me if you agree with this, too. I know that they've got to then report back to the media, back to the people of Chicago, but doesn't it seem like the longer the strike goes on, the more strident the language is getting on both sides, the angrier each side is at the other side? You almost wonder if we, you know, shame on me for saying this because I'm at the media, right? It would almost be better if they didn't talk to any of us anymore. What they should say is, we're not going to name call. We're not going to label the other side's intentions or motives. We're just going to continue to work on this. And you'll hear back from us in a week. You know, don't give us daily reports. Don't give us hourly reports. Maybe don't give us any at all until you're done. That would be an extreme case. But do you see where I'm going with this? The Bears was the subject of the WGN Radio News Click today. Actually, that's the one we still have up. We put it up yesterday. The Bears, dot, dot, dot. Lauren Lapka, how did you vote on the Bears? I'll give you your four options. Are you ready?
Yep.
A, we'll make it. Rough start, but don't panic. Or B, the Bears will maybe make it. Oh, but my head hurts. Not so sure. C, probably are not a playoff team after all, and D, a whole bunch of cuss words.
D.
I know, D got the second most votes, by the way. 60% of you said probably aren't a playoff team now. C was the most popular answer. My answer was, I'm somewhere between A and B. I mean, I can't believe how badly this team has started, but I also think they're going to be in the playoffs. So I think they will make it. Rough start. Panic a little bit, but not too much. I am not at the C level yet. Probably aren't a playoff team after all. Got a half a minute for a call. Hey, John, the Bears will what? You're on WGN.
John, good afternoon. How are you?
What do you say? Bears are in, Bears are out?
Well, I think the Bears are going to be out as long as they keep playing an air raid siren every minute. I mean, my God, how can Matt Nagy even think? He went from the best coach last year to the worst coach this year. And I don't blame him. I mean, he's got an air raid siren going off in his ear every minute.
Yeah, I'm out of time. I wanted to get your view. We'll talk more about this later. Thanks for the call.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Doing my best.
Here's John Williams.
Doesn't always work out. This is John. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. Appreciate you tuning in. We're here weekdays on this show, 1 to 3. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, right around the corner. They'll be here at 3 o'clock. Remember, you can check my show out on Saturday mornings, too, from 10 to noon. All right, I'm now going to segue from that to part of the theme song for our friend Joel Stein.
But now he's got his own cartoon show on VH1.
He once had a cartoon show on VH1.
But even though the show has got a standard sitcom feel, all the interviews with famous people are for real. Joel likes to ask him questions that'll make him squirm. Sometimes he gets punched out, but Joel never learns. Hey Joel, what do you know? You got your own show. Try not to blow it, cause if you're not funny, then you'll soon be gone. Make it fill the time with some more Lenny Kravitz songs, then you'll be back in obscurity where you belong.
Hey Joel! I don't know if you understood all of that, but that really is the theme song to a cartoon show about Joel Stein, who you may recall for 20 years was a Time magazine columnist. He had the back page. He would ask questions that would make his guests squirm, and maybe he did get punched out. On the back of his latest book, The Flap, the biographical part reads, among other things, Time Magazine, 20 years, Entertainment Weekly, Los Angeles Times, the author of Man Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity. And then it says there is no factual basis for his claim that his writing has, quote, saved millions of lives and destroyed many more marriages. It's the first time I've ever seen, Joel, the bio book flap actually fact-checked and determined to be not entirely honest. And now Joel sounds like he can't hear us. Hey, Joel.
No. Hey, I wanted more theme song. I was holding off, hoping you'd play some more of it.
Did they do, you know, like back in the, when I was a kid, they'd have the cartoon, or even like Gilligan's Island, they would have the theme song.
Yes.
But then they'd have the longer version you'd get on some episodes. Is that what you were hoping for?
I was, yeah. There's the part that they play at the end during the credits, which has even more lyrics that
yeah.
I enjoy.
Yeah. How are
I
you, Joel Stein?
I'm good. I miss you. I'm glad to be talking to you.
In Defense of Elitism is your latest book. It's a book that you told me you were going to write a long time ago, and I counseled you at least against the title. I said, don't do that, Joel. So what did you do?
That's right.
You called it In Defense of Elitism.
Yeah. I don't make the best choices. That's been a general rule in my life.
I don't know.
You think I have?
Well, how's the book doing? Is it just out now, and how's it going?
Today. It's the first day it's out. I mean, you can't find it in bookstores. I assume that's a good thing, but it might be a bad thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, generally you want it in the stores. Okay.
I thought maybe it was sold out, but maybe that's not what's going on.
No, it's not there yet, Joel. There's a difference.
Jesus.
So
yeah, that's unfortunate.
So tell us what you did. I mean, I read the book yesterday and today.
You did?
It's pretty good.
Thank you.
It's pretty good.
It's a quick read. It's got a large font and big margins.
It does. So, I noticed that. Yep. I thought, how am I going to get through this? It's like everything you write. It has many kernels of truth. It's very funny. You roll your eyes sometimes. And the large font was very helpful.
Well, you know, what happened is I wanted to write as short a book as they would let me They feel like it has to be a certain length to charge full price. So I wrote I cut it down as short as I could, and then I figured it'd be a 200-page book, and it came back at 300 something pages. My publisher did that trick that they do in college, which is to expand the margins.
Yeah.
And the font. It's crazy.
I used to do this as a kid in grade school. They'd say you have to write a 2-page paper, and you'd use your largest handwriting possible to fill out the pages. That's what you did here.
That's what the professionals do. So, yeah, I freaked out when the night Trump won. Not because he was a Republican. I have lots of winemaking friends who are Republicans. But I freaked out because it was the first time a populist had beat a member of the elite since Andrew Jackson beat John Quincy Adams. And we were going to have someone running our country who just operates from their gut, who knows more than the generals, and is calling every part of the Constitution phony like he was a Holden Caulfield. So I just panicked. I'm still in panic that we keep, you know, we're trying to tear down the system we have that's run by experts and put people who don't know anything in charge.
Yeah. Yeah, that point you make clear at the beginning of the book, that we need to sort of, whatever you think of Donald Trump or Republicans or Democrats or liberals, it just doesn't make any sense. In no other quarter of our life do we hand important decisions over to people who aren't experts. You want an expert physician, you want an expert banker to help you with your financing. So why do we then say that being an elite in running the country is a bad idea?
So I do lots of things in the book. Like I go to the county in America, the highest percentage of Trump voters. But there is a part, there's a little chapter on doctors, because everyone like goes to WebMD now and reads some article or two, and then they argue with their doctors. So I found that Kaiser Permanente hires a bunch of actors to do all kinds of things, including like high school plays about STDs, which by the way, they call downtown souvenirs, which is my favorite new euphemism for STDs. But one thing they do is they get actors to do improvisation doctors to teach them how to deal with patients who argue with them after like reading some Suzanne Summers book. And I found that part, and I kind of replicated that with one of these people who worked for Kaiser, one of these actors, and a doctor friend of mine. And I found it to be really scary where we're at.
Why do you say that?
Well, mostly because my wife once argued with a doctor who was trying to give me really good advice because she had been convinced I had some kind of, I don't know, cancer or thyroid node, or I don't know what she thought. But it turns out it was a much simpler thing, which was that we were in a small fishing village in Mexico and I got food poisoning.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember reading about that. Yeah. I wasn't there. You didn't invite me.
No, I called you. I called everyone as soon as it happened.
Well, but doesn't WebMD give us maybe a better baseline of knowledge?
Yeah.
I mean, that can't be a bad thing, right?
No, I know a doctor who writes WebMD articles, and he once was in the weird position of having one of his patients argue with his diagnosis and hand him a printout of a WebMD article he had written. So, no, it's great that people go, doctors love it when you go in informed. It saves them a lot of time, and they can have a much smarter conversation with you. But to think that you know more from reading one or two pieces than someone who's, you know, seen thousands of patients and went to med school is insane. And that's it's happening in all parts of our lives. Like someone writes a tweet or a blog, and it kind of looks as smart as the tweet or article from someone from the Council of Foreign Relations. But they know a lot more about the Middle East than you know. And I think we have to kind of accept that and understand that, or we're going to make a mess of the world.
So you talk about that in general terms, and sometimes it's about WebMD, but by and large, it's sort of this look at the politics of the last election. And you go to a town called Miami, Texas, right, where the it's the highest percentage of people that voted for the president in the United States in a county, and then you also go to sort of an elite capital later in the book. But talk to me about
my block.
Talk to me about your experience in Texas. Why did you go there, and what did you find when you went there?
So I figured I would go there and kind of teach them the error of their ways, and then they would probably teach me a couple of things that I could stitch on a doily and put in my house. But instead, I found out that they knew more about my life than I knew about theirs, because they have televisions and they travel to cities, and I had no real cause to go to a town this small and spend a whole week there before. And so I'd never been to like a super white, super Christian, small oil and gas and ranching town. And what I learned was that the smug elitist attitude of these, that often my friends will say, well, these people just haven't been informed and they're voting against their own interests. And that's definitely not what's going on. They're voting for what they want for the country, the same way that elitists will vote for higher taxes for themselves. And they're worried that the values that they hold dear as white Christians in rural America are going away. And, you know, you notice like acceleration more than you notice speed. And even though they're still the most powerful group in the country, they're noticing that they have less power than they used to, and they don't like the changes that are taking place.
Give me an example.
I think they feel like a lot of it has to do with traditional roles of men and women. A lot of it has to do with, you know, respect for Christianity as kind of a center of decision making in this country. So I think they're worried. They'll phrase it as far as in terms of Western culture more than whiteness or Christianity. But I think they feel like there's just a multicultural world where there are no more rules.
Yeah, well, so the way you put it was, I mean, you touched on a number of things there. I like that you sort of got into a disagreement with one of them about the separation of church and state. And he said, well, you know, it's not in the Constitution. And you rolled your eyes at that because, of course, it's in the Constitution. Then you went home and looked it up and saw it wasn't in the Constitution, right?
Yeah, it was pretty embarrassing. Just one of many embarrassing things that happened to me in this book.
I know that, yeah, but I mean, but where you were anyway was this super white, super Christian, mm-hmm. conservative, dry county. And,
oh, yes. And so, it's reporting so hard. To get people to open up to you over dinner without any alcohol? Oh.
Well,
I wish that upon any reporter.
So, but let's just skip ahead a little bit. I'm going to quote you to
yeah.
you.
Oh, I love that.
Well, so you're writing about this, and I'm like, geez, Joel, what are you doing? You're coming in there with that snippy, elite,
yeah.
Stanford-educated, Time Magazine attitude of yours. They're going to have you for a snack, right? And mm-hmm. I was impressed with how open and warm you were to them. And even though they would say things that just made your jaw drop about blacks and about immigrants and about Jews or other minorities, you know, some of it was really hard to even read. They were so nice, and they were so nice to you. And you wrote this: I like my new Baptist friends. They're smart. And that was another thing. If you think that these people are ill-educated, or not curious, maybe they're not as curious as they could be, but they're not dumb, and they're not all poor, these people you were talking to either. I mean, they have opportunity. You write, they're smart, thoughtful, and except for this one guy, Jerry, friendly. Not one person here has once looked at their phone. Think about that. You're in the company of people, strangers or friends. No one's looking at their phone. You wrote, I wish Cassandra, that's your wife, and Laszlo, your son, had come. He would love it here with the Model A, Ford, the pasturing animals, the unhurried pace. I tell myself that I'm giving him a better life with museums, concerts, ceramics classes, diversity, a school carefully selected for his needs. But I'm pretty sure he'd prefer running around this town. And then you write, without alcohol, it is difficult to discern when a large gathering is ending. We are not about to run out of water, and no one's going to say anything so horrible we're all forced to leave. So instead, a few people talk about being tired, and we disperse. But that's sort of the end of one of your days with the group. And I thought that was a sweet and fair-minded paragraph or two of yours, Joel.
Yeah, I left there thinking that there's definitely a better way to live than I'm doing. I mean, I went to church with them, and they gathered at a dinner afterwards, and they were always hanging out with each other on the porch. And I did feel like it was a better sense of community than I have. So I felt like I could learn about how to live from them, and they could learn about how to vote from me.
Well, so then, all right, but if that's what you got from them, were you able to impart any wisdom on them? Did you shed any light maybe on how they shouldn't fear the things they're so fearful of? I mean, tell me what you accomplished from their perspective after this. Our friend Joel Stein, the darty one, has a new book in defense of elitism, Why I'm Better Than You and You Are Better Than Someone Who Didn't Buy This Book, writes Joel Stein. Right on the cover, Joel. Very funny stuff and very thoughtful, too. So just before the break, you were telling us how you got something out of visiting this very conservative county after the last election. Were you able to lay any wisdom on them? Did they change for your better in any way?
We'll be fully in the Democratic camp next election.
I missed the first part of that. You got to say it again, Joel.
Oh, I predict that Miami, Texas will be fully in the Democratic camp in the next election.
Yeah.
You heard it here. Check the maps in 2020.
What a swing.
I'm pretty sure.
95-96% to the other way.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
They said it couldn't be done, but I'm pretty sure I did it.
Come on now. Were you able? I mean, did they ever go, well, thanks, Joel, what do you know? Maybe we shouldn't have pulled out of Syria, or I don't know. Was there anything where you saw a light come on in their head? Were they receptive like you?
Yeah, you know, I don't think you change people's minds by arguing with them. They think the left is so angry right now and irrational that I think I at least presented a reasonable and civil front, which is about as best as we can do right now, I think.
Do you suppose...
I'm saying no. I'm just basically saying no. Yeah.
Well, would you say this, though, Joel? It's almost... What you accomplished is not that you went to try to convince them, or
that's
that
right.
You did
I
convince
like this.
Them. But that you were simply there, that when you left,
that's right.
As the taillights disappeared in the sun, they go, he wasn't so bad, and he was an elite.
Well, maybe so, because, and thank you for saying all that and giving me a reason to live, but they had been really angry at CNN, the way they were portrayed there in this town right after the election. And I've gotten a call from both Jerry and Deanne, the main characters in this book, because I sent them my book, and I was very, very worried that they would hate it.
Yeah.
I didn't care if Tucker Carlson, who I interview in the book, doesn't like it. I didn't care if Bill Kristol or the Dilbert guy, Scott Adams. If they don't like it, I'm fine with that. But I really wanted the people in Miami at least to feel like I gave an accurate portrayal of their town. And so far, both Jerry and Deanne liked it a lot. So I felt really, really relieved.
That's good, because you tell some truths about them that I think some people
yes.
would find it difficult to swallow. If they own that and are still... happy. I don't know if I'm encouraged or discouraged, but I have to go. But I like this book more than I thought I would, Joel.
Oh my God! Can I use that as a blurb?
It's good to talk to you, my friend. Well done. The book is called "In Defense of Elitism." It's by Joel Stein. It'll be on the bestseller list soon. Its pub date is today. Nicely done, Joel.
Oh, thank you very, very much, sir. And thank you for playing my theme song again.
It's 228 on WGN.
I want to talk to God, but I'm afraid because we ain't spoken so long. God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down.
238 WGN. Thank you, Jordan. John Williams here.
Don't fail me now.
While you're playing Kanye West, producer Ella.
In an interview with a Christian media organization, a pastor said Kanye West told him that he's considered quitting rap because it's, quote, the devil's music.
Well, what was he did the, he was doing sermons, right? He was doing sort of, he would preach at these concert things. He did one in Chicago,
Sunday,
right?
Sunday sermons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is he going to start doing Christian-like music or change his lyrics or something?
No, he just told this pastor that he was going to quit altogether, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I don't want him to.
Yeah, actually, I don't agree with everything Kanye says, but I've liked a lot of his music. He's an artist.
He's talented.
It's 238. This is WGN. By the way, quick shout-out, speaking of sports, we're about to, with the executive director of the IHSA, not just about sports, but a lot about that, but a quick shout-out to the University of Illinois football team. The Fighting Illini, I was clicking around this weekend to watch something. I meant to mention this yesterday, and I thought, Illinois, well, they'll get blown out. Let's watch Wisconsin just pounce them. Wisconsin undefeated, sixth-ranked best team in the country. Illinois just can't seem to do anything right in football these days. Lovey looks like Santa Claus. Just none of it makes sense out there. And then Illinois, with a last-second field goal, wins the game. I stormed the field.
How amazing is that?
That was so much fun. It was their homecoming, and it was just like, oh, my gosh. I've never felt happier for the Illini than I did at that game. especially since the kid that goes out to kick the game-winning field goal with like 3 seconds left on the clock, right? This is the last play of the game. You either win your homecoming or you don't. Had previously in that game missed a makeable 40-yard field goal. This one was about as long. I think it was 38, 39 yards. And he put it right through the uprights.
Movie plot moments.
Oh, man. It was just so much fun. So hats off to the Illini. Maybe that'll turn. I mean, literally the announcers were saying, this is a program moment, this win. Hopefully they'll be able to capitalize on that. Craig Anderson is the executive director of the Illinois High School Association. He joins us now on WGN Radio. Craig, thanks for taking our call. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You sound like you're on the road. Did we catch you in a good spot? What are you up to today, sir?
Yeah, I was over a couple of days, or just a day, in Indianapolis for some meetings where our National Federation of State High School Associations are. I was on a task force, and so I'm just headed back to the office today.
I appreciate your time then. As you know well, in Chicago, we're not only hopeful that they'll get the strike resolved so that everybody will be happy and the students will be back in the classroom, but there's also this issue about could the kids do extracurricular activity even though the teachers are still on strike. What are the rules or guidelines from the IHSA about that?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. And let's talk about during the regular season. So when regular season games are scheduled, it's really left to the local school to determine if they're going to let their teams participate. It's generally typically the case that when schools go on strike, obviously there's an overlap of coaches and teachers, and so it's considered to be crossing the lines if they would ask or expect their teaching coaches to coach. So generally districts will shut down their athletic teams, both practice and competition, while they are on strike. So that puts us into questions, obviously, then about what happens during our state series. So we have a policy that specifically directs what the limits are related or opportunities for kids when schools go on strike. And so when a tournament is already in session and then a school goes on strike, once our tournament state series has begun, students are allowed to continue to participate in the state series. And so this fall, prior to the Chicago Public Schools going on strike, we had our 1A boys soccer tournament and our boys and girls golf tournaments underway. And CPS students could have, and teams could have, continued to participate, but the CPS chose not to. And that's not atypical. That's very typical that that's the decision. So that happened. And so the policy goes on to say if a school is on strike prior to one of our state series beginning, then the schools can't participate. And so that was the circumstance with our girls tennis players and our 2A and 3A boys soccer teams that limited their participation in those state series.
That wouldn't affect football, though, right? Because the state playoffs haven't started for football yet.
Exactly. So as long as we get the strike settled very soon, our playoffs don't start till a week from this Friday. So, again, within some provisions, so some uniqueness about football is that there's a practice piece to all of this.
Yeah.
So if they get the strike settled in time and can begin to get back practicing, then those teams should be eligible and ready to participate in our playoffs coming up November 1st and 2nd.
This is the adults making the decisions, but the adults could decide. For instance, CPS could have said that the kids could be playing in these sports, at least the ones that started before the strike, right?
That's exactly correct, yeah. So, like, as I mentioned, the 1A soccer teams and the girls and boys golf participants could have continued until they finished their experience or lost or, you know, possibly won a championship. But it wasn't the provision that was available to the bigger schools, our 2A, 3A boys soccer teams, and then our girls tennis teams. And as a result, we've moved on with those tournaments, and while it's kind of been known that schools, CPS schools, have appealed our policy to possibly reinstate the 2A, 3A soccer teams or even the girls' tennis participants. But because we've already moved on into the tournament, that's nearly impossible. I mean, we've got game schedules. We've got to move on through our tournament as matchups continue and the bracket funnels down to our state championship. For those tournaments.
You said the CPS made the decision not to let the kids participate, but I wonder if the teacher coaches themselves would have wanted to. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I don't. You know, I'm sure there's thoughts on both sides of that. And, you know, if they were coaches were given the option, you know, that's a difficult position to be put in because, you know, you're part of the union. You want to be loyal to the union and the work stoppage that, you know, for all of the reasons they're trying to do the benefits to the education, all the things that they're fighting for, to say that, you know, we're going to give you the option to come over here and work and practice and then possibly compete, really puts them in turmoil. And so that's why I shared that, in general, districts, for the most part, won't even put that in a position for their teacher coaches, because they generally understand that's a tough decision for a teacher or coach to make that choice.
But they're going to get paid either way, is my understanding, correct?
Yeah, typically when there's, again, when it's a strike is not increasingly long, that there will be that pay, the back pay that they'll get once the strike is settled. And you know, they're required by the state to have a certain number of days in, and they'll put those days at the end of the school year. So, yeah, they'll get paid, likely get paid their salary that they're expected to have.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have all those days of school.
Now, you mentioned golf and tennis. Obviously, people think about football, but those are all sports. This is also true, correct, for non-sporting extracurricular activities, right?
Yeah, this would apply to our sports and our activities, correct. We don't have many activities, state series underway or here the upcoming. You know, we do have, you mentioned, football coming up in a week, but we have cross-country regionals that are scheduled to start this Saturday. And so we're at a critical point now moving in late into this week. We'll do our very best if the strike gets settled sometime the end of this week and prior to our regional starting on Saturday, it will be our goal to get those students back participating in our state series in cross country on Saturday. And then volleyball, girls volleyball regionals start on Monday. So we have some sports upcoming that settling this strike is going to provide opportunities for those students to compete in the state series.
You know, I'm sure that every parent and every athlete feels like they worked as hard as anybody. But I'm thinking about the cross-country kids now who ran how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles this summer and this fall to try and get to that point where they can compete at the end of the season. And it's a whole training regimen, and it's just a lot of lonely hours of work and a lot of pain for those kids. And then they look at the calendar and go, wow, they're still on strike. After all of that, I'm not going to be able to run in the meet. I just got a text from somebody, and they said, John, cross-country regionals are this Saturday. Of the 9 teams slated at our regional, 5 are Chicago Public Schools. So those kids, unless they have a resolution by Friday, won't be able to run, right?
That's correct. Yeah, and I know one regional has the potential to only have 2, while it's scheduled to have 9 participating, one of the other regionals may only have 2 if the CPS teams aren't able to participate. So it's a tough circumstance. You know, I'm very hopeful that we settle this strike soon. The sooner the better, of course. But on behalf of the runners, and you said every reason why, and you hit the nail on the head, the training and the preparation with everything. Segregating just the cross-country runners, but for all the student-athletes, you know, they gear up for this opportunity at the culminating point at their season to participate in the state series. And so we're hopeful, I know many listeners are, that we get to that point and we can get this strike settled and move forward.
Well, I suppose this is naive, Craig Anderson's on a line, the executive director of the Illinois High School Association, because I'm not in the teachers union, but if you and I were at that school and you were the football coach or the cross-country coach, the golf coach, and you went ahead and said, hey, guys, listen, I'm going to quote-unquote cross the line, and we're going to coach, we're going to field a team, and the CPS is going to allow it, and I'm going to take the kids to the state regionals or the state tournaments. As a fellow but striking teacher, I don't think I would hold that against you. I don't see how you doing that hurts our bargaining position. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of flaws with my logic and my attitude there, but just sitting here right now, that's where my heart is on this, Craig.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the language of our policy, while they could have done that, as I mentioned, had their state series been underway, we don't allow that for schools. And so while they may have wanted to do that, per our policies, we would have prevented it. We just take the position that once, if a strike is ongoing and now we're entering into a state series, we just don't allow those schools to participate. But I get what you're saying. That could be the perspective of many, that it, you know, it's more about the day routine versus the evening routine of practice and competition, that you know, people may not think so harshly about someone continuing in that role as a coach.
Well, I think this is why my friend Eric Zorn, the Tribune columnist, called it somewhat arbitrary. I mean, if that's the problem, you hate to put a teacher in that position. But shoot, if the tournament started before the strike, that teacher is effectively going to cross the picket line anyway with their team, or at least they have that opportunity to. So we've already sort of made the decision that under some circumstances, a teacher coach can coach even though they're on strike. You could, if you can do that, extend it to teachers and coaches after the strike has started as well. You know, that's his attitude, and I understand that. I appreciate what you're saying, too, though. I would hate to be in the position as a teacher coach to have to make up that decision while my peers are standing there, you know, on the street corner with signs in their hands.
Yeah, for sure. And, we're a membership association. Many folks know that. And so our rules, and these in particular, are developed by they're part of our board policy. And so our principals have established these rules, and I think, you know, they're looking at it, you know, maybe not thinking about the number of schools like this strike is affected, but simply trying not to use the students, coaches, and the teams as pawns related to a strike as a part of the reason that we have the policy that we do have in place.
But, yeah. Well, I think the result is that the students do feel that way, though, because they're being held out. It's going to pressure. Now who gets more pressure, right? The CPS or the CTU? But maybe it's going to pressure the CTU to compromise more because the kids want to go back and the teachers want to coach. We are out of time. I appreciate your time and your travel today, Craig. Drive safely. Thanks for joining us, and maybe we'll visit with you again later in the week.
Sounds good. I appreciate you having me, John.
Craig Anderson's the executive director of the Illinois High School Association. 773 texted in. I'm guessing my kids will be missing their cross country. They ran all summer trying to practice for this Saturday's competition. We can't even ask our teachers since they only use CPS email accounts.